Chapter 6, Text 10. Yogi yunjita satatam atmanang rahasi sthitaha ekaki yata chittatma nirashira parigraha. So, translation. A transcendentalist should always engage his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. He should live alone in a secluded place and should always carefully control his mind. He should be free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. Purport: Krishna is realized in different degrees as Brahman, Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna consciousness means, concisely, to be always engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. But those who are attached to the impersonal Brahman or the localized Supersoul are also partially Krishna conscious, because the impersonal Brahman is the spiritual ray of Krishna and the Supersoul is the all-pervading partial expansion of Krishna. Thus, the impersonalist and the meditator are also indirectly Krishna conscious. A directly Krishna conscious person is the topmost transcendentalist, because such a devotee knows what is meant by Brahman and Paramatma. His knowledge of the Absolute Truth is perfect, whereas the impersonalist and the meditative yogi are imperfectly Krishna conscious. Nevertheless, all of these are instructed herewith to be constantly engaged in their particular pursuits so that they may come to the highest perfection sooner or later. The first business of a transcendentalist is to keep the mind always on Krishna. One should always think of Krishna and not forget him even for a moment. Concentration of the mind on the Supreme is called samadhi or trance. In order to concentrate the mind, one should always remain in seclusion and avoid disturbance by external objects. He should be very careful to accept favorable and reject unfavorable conditions that affect his realization. And in perfect determination, he should not hanker after unnecessary material things that entangle him by feelings of possessiveness. All these perfections and precautions are perfectly executed when one is directly in Krishna consciousness, because direct Krishna consciousness means self-abnegation, wherein there is very little chance for material possessiveness. Srila Rupa Goswami characterizes Krishna consciousness in this way: anasaktasya vishayan yataham upayunjataha nibandha krishna sambandhe yuktam vairagya muchyate prapanchikataya buddhya hari sambandhi vastunaha mumukshubhi parityago vairagyam phalgu kathyate. When one is not attached to anything, but at the same time accepts everything in relation to Krishna, one is rightly situated above possessiveness. On the other hand, one who rejects everything without knowledge of its relationship to Krishna is not as complete in his renunciation. From Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu: a Krishna conscious person well knows that everything belongs to Krishna, and thus he is always free from feelings of personal possession. As such, he has no hankering for anything on his own personal account. He knows how to accept things in favor of Krishna consciousness and how to reject things unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. He is always aloof from material things because he is always transcendental, and he is always alone, having nothing to do with persons not in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, a person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. So in this verse, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is describing some of the essential characteristics of a yogi. One of them is that he always lives alone in a secluded place. He's not attracted by anything material. He's free from the feeling of possessiveness. Srila Prabhupada in his purport makes a case for the devotees of Krishna being the topmost yogis, but It might not seem that the devotees of Krishna under the guidance of Srila Prabhupada exhibit these qualities because they don't live alone. In fact, just the opposite. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always recommended that we remain in asat sangatiyag. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommended to give up the association of non-devotees or of anything non-devotional. And then among the five important essential processes of Krishna consciousness, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommended sadhu sangha. We often hear the term sadhu sangha, not only among devotees of Krishna, in Hinduism in general, to use that misused term. Sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, sarva shastri kailava matra sadhu sangha sarva siddhi hoy. Even a moment's association with a pure devotee can, or with sadhus, can bestow all success. Now this seems to be just the opposite of being all alone. And in fact, the whole mission of Srila Prabhupada appears to be fostering an atmosphere quite different to that described here. When we read this verse, we think of a yogi going into a forest or into a mountain cave, living all alone, having no possessions. Srila Prabhupada describes how the devotee of Krishna lives among such things, among such apparent opulence, and remains alone, free from the feeling of possessiveness. This, he quotes Rupa Goswami's discussion of, or description of, Yukta Vairagya and Phalgu Vairagya. That one who just gives Phalgu Vairagya is one who proposes or purports to give up the world. Just, I'm giving up everything. But he doesn't see that everything has its relationship with Krishna and Krishna's service. Whereas the Yukta Vairagi engages everything in Krishna's service. And thus he lives in the world while being Padma Patram Ivambhasa, just like a lotus leaf which lives in the water but is aloof from it. And if a drop of water drops on it, it won't remain very long. Kamala dala jala jivana talamala, that example is given. Life is fleeting, like a drop of water on a lotus leaf. This description of Yukta Vairagya and Phalgu Vairagya was essential to the preaching mission of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, or rather he interpreted this in a way that no acharya previous to him had done. Devotees traditionally had gone to holy places, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had recommended, Mathura Vas, living in Mathura, or non-different, Navadvip Dham, or Jagannath Puri, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did, mostly in these places, and in other places also, living alone from the common populace, and leading very detached lives. There are many descriptions of devotees who, and even today we can find in places like Govardhan, places like, well, there are not many of them, maybe in Govardhan, some. And in the region of Raja, especially Raja Mandala, sadhus who live, who make a point of living very simply, with very few possessions, just so that they can be aloof from the world and absorbed in bhajan, activities of remembrance of Krishna. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took up the preaching mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which requires to live in the world. You can't preach to the world and be aloof from it simultaneously. You've got, Well, you can, that's the whole point, but at least physically, one has to be involved. You can't preach to people by just ignoring them. You have to mix with them. And there has to be some meeting of minds. There has to be some meeting of some feeling between the people. There has to be some level of there has to be some level of respect from the common people to the devotees if they're going to preach to them, especially at some level of accept or of respect or at least acceptance, which largely wasn't there at the time when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was preaching in Bengal. Vaishnava sadhus were considered to be a class of beggars, and often they were equated with some of the worst kinds of misbehavior. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wanted to preach Krishna consciousness on the order of his guru, on the order of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So to capture the attention, or to at least to attract the attention of materialistic people, he arranged for mutts, or living quarters for sadhus, which were, we might say, from the materialistic point of view, somewhat decent residences. He attracted highly educated people who could speak with other highly educated people on their own level. He himself set this example of this by being highly educated, not only in scriptural topics, but also in the same kind of material topics that were prominent in the discourse of people in that time and place in Bengal at the turn of the 19th, 20th century and up to the 1930s. So in doing so, he broke with tradition, and he also broke many rules. Sending devotees to preach in motor cars was considered something very wrong, because strict sadhus, they don't even go on bullock carts. They're only supposed to walk. So that was one rule broken. There were many wearing stitched cloth, speaking in English. Sadhus don't do that, at least in the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. They weren't supposed to speak in English. It's a foreign language. So in many ways, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur broke the tradition, broke rules. Brahmanas are only... Well, that was another big thing. He's awarding the status of Brahmanas to persons not born in Brahmana families. And then he would feed them more than twice a day. Brahmanas are only supposed to eat at midday, one meal, and then again they can eat another meal at night before resting. That's the tradition and the rule since time immemorial. So he broke many rules, apparently, but the purpose was to bring people to the ultimate principle. Otherwise, people were following the rules but missing the point. That becomes an instance of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur introduced an apparent case of niyamagraha to combat another form of niyamagraha. Niyamagraha is one of the six factors which shadbhya bhaktiya prasid pranashyati, which destroy bhakti. So one of those is to be overly concerned with the rules and regulations, but without accepting the essence of them. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur combated that by niyama agraha, not accepting certain rules, in the name of yukta vairagya, concentrating on the all-important rule, smartavya satatam Vishnu, vismartavya najatu chit, to always think of Krishna, and to never forget him. So it was scandalous in the eyes of some, but it did the trick, it did the job. Krishna consciousness was spread. That doesn't mean that the rules are not important, but under the guidance of an expert acharya, certain less important rules can be relaxed or just not followed for the sake of establishing the most important rule, or that is to think of Krishna. That's not just a rule, that's the very goal of life. And our own Srila Prabhupada was expert in applying this principle. If he had not done, he wouldn't have been able to preach in America. He wouldn't have been able to go to America, because that's another rule. You're not supposed to cross the ocean. Anyone who goes outside Bharatavarsha, especially crossing the ocean, is proscribed. Then you lose your caste. Of course, a Vaishnava doesn't care for caste anyway. But although Indians, for trading purposes, had been going overseas to what is now called Indonesia and Southeast Asia and what are now the Persian Gulf countries, although there were no such countries at the time, and even as far as Astrakhan in South Russia, there were Bhatia, Sindhi Bhatia traders had a colony there. They had a temple of Srinathji, their worship. They brought their Brahmin with them also. Some Brahmin agreed to lose his caste by going to Russia. So that was strongly proscribed. And even recently, one of the Madhva Sampradaya sannyasis was almost got thrown out of the Madhva Sampradaya for the crime of going to America. He lived it out. He lived out the storm when he came back. Went to America. He didn't go to visit Disneyland, as far as I know. He went to minister to the large community of Madhva Brahmanas who are settled in America, or at least semi-settled in America. Most of them working for Bill Gates or the ex-Steve Jobs, and for similar professions, computer professionals mostly. They're also not supposed to have gone overseas, but they did, and they still want to remain connected with the Madhva Sampradaya. So the point I'm making here is that there have been many adjustments, and there probably will be many adjustments to the modern way of life, which is very different to pristine Vedic culture. So many adjustments may have to be made, but this doesn't mean that rules and regulations are not important, or that the rules are there to help us advance in Krishna consciousness. And we shouldn't glibly or lightly just reject them. They are rules. Rules don't matter, just think of Krishna. But the rules are there to help us think of Krishna. They're there to help prepare our consciousness to be suitable for remembering Krishna, for putting us in the mode of goodness. Certain rules are there just because Krishna likes them. Krishna likes that his devotees will, for instance, fast on Ekadashi and observe festivals such as Janmashtami. So the rules are important, although yukta vairagya, that the the execution of Yukta Vairagya, particularly according to the interpretation of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, it seems to presuppose the breaking of some rules. Now the important point here is this Yukta Vairagya. Vairagya means one is not attached to anything of this world. So if we just want to break some rules because we can't be bothered to follow them, or because we think, well, anyway, I'm a devotee, so what does it matter? I love Krishna, so what does it matter if I follow the rules or not? That is not a devotional way of thinking. That is a hypocritical way of thinking. That is not on the basis of detachment. The basis of detachment for the non-devotional yogi is he is trying to overcome the attraction of his senses from the sense objects by understanding that this is very bad for me, it causes my entanglement. I have to become aloof from this. But a devotee, a practicing devotee also cultivates such understanding, but his prime motive, as stated here, if I know, how do you work this thing? Anyway. Nope, Yukta Vairagya, don't throw it out the window. I don't know how to, it's the first time I know how to use a Kindle. So, yeah, it's not so convenient as a book, is it? Where you have to try and find this. Yeah, a devotee has no... Because a Krishna-conscious person well knows that everything belongs to Krishna, he is always free from feelings of personal possession. That's the platform on which a devotee is not attached to this world, he's detached. As such, he has no hankering for anything on his own personal account. He knows how to accept things in favor of Krishna consciousness and how to reject things unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. He is always aloof from material things because he is always transcendental. This is obviously open to abuse. A devotee may say that, well, I have to have the most expensive car, more than the Swami down the road, because just to show how renounced I am. Or one may live in opulent quarters for the sake of preaching. Srila Prabhupada, when he first came to America, he was living among the bums on Bowery, and some hippies who were higher class than the bums, but still in the lower strata of American society, or actually somewhat equivalent to the outcasts of the, compared to the caste people in India, they were the outcasts. So the hippies and the bums, they were just not really, not part of American society at all. The hippies didn't, they deliberately identified themselves as not being part of that society. So Srila Prabhupada started his preaching in New York City in that condition. Later, he got very opulent apartments, and you can still see them. They're preserved, for instance, in London at Bhaktivedanta Manor, and Melbourne. He has very opulent apartments. So when Srila Prabhupada first started his preaching in the West, he had no facility and no one of any substance in material terms was coming to hear him. Later, when he got these opulent apartments, then all kinds of big important people in material terms came to see him, and particularly in London, almost every day for some period, all kinds of well-known and prominent people in the world in London were brought to meet Srila Prabhupada, and he preached to them Krishna consciousness. So there is a very good example of a devotee, in this case Srila Prabhupada, exhibiting Yukta Vairagya. He wasn't attached to opulent circumstances, but he knew how to utilize them in Krishna's service. In January 1977, Srila Prabhupada stayed for several weeks at ISKCON Bhuvaneshwar, which at that time consisted of two small mud huts with a hand pump for water. He could have stayed in any of his opulent apartments all over the world, but he chose to stay there, thus exhibiting that he wasn't attached to opulent apartments. He wanted to show that a devotee, even if he has all facility, of course I shouldn't claim to read Srila Prabhupada's intentions, but he did show by doing so that a devotee, even if he has all facilities for living comfortably, he should be happy to live in any situation, especially if he's in the association of devotees. Tandera charane shevi bhakti shane vash chaname janame hoy eyo bhilash. So one has to be detached and use everything in Krishna's service. As Srila Prabhupada said, if one uses one farthing for sense gratification, he goes to hell. So even though one may have all kinds of facilities for serving Krishna, it should be specifically for serving Krishna, and the motive should not be to enjoy anything of this world. One should be aloof from material things and always transcendental. Now, how far does this Yukta Vairagya go? Well, it doesn't go anywhere unless we are actually detached from the world. It's not Vairagya at all. First of all, there has to be Vairagya, then there can be Yukta Vairagya. How far can you take this? If there's rule breaking, how far can you take it? Well, the answer seems to be that you can take it to any length, as long as Krishna is served. For instance, when the then Harikesh Maharaj was ordered by Srila Prabhupada to preach Krishna consciousness in Russia, this was in the mid-1970s, Harikesh Swami protested in various ways why it was not a good reason for him to go to the Soviet Union at that time. He said, well, there's no good association there. And Srila Prabhupada said to him, you should be very careful of this so-called good association. Interesting reply. His last, after offering various excuses why he shouldn't go, which Srila Prabhupada countered one by one, Harikesh Maharaj's last attempt, his trump card, was that, well, there's nothing to eat there except meat. To which Srila Prabhupada replied, then eat meat, but go there and preach Krishna consciousness. Actually, there was something else to eat apart from meat. Not that much else, but it was possible to live without eating meat. So the idea was given there that if required for spreading Krishna consciousness, one can eat meat. It is not recommended in ordinary circumstances. And in fact, Srila Prabhupada himself on another occasion had said that he would rather die than eat meat. But the general idea is that one can do anything if Krishna's mission is served by doing so, but it requires great transcendental intelligence and detachment from personal sense gratification, and to have conquered the mind, that's another symptom of the yogi, to have conquered the mind and not be ruled by the mind, to understand what should be done and what should not be done in Krishna's service. How far can Yukta Vairagya go? How about breaking the Guru's direct order? That doesn't sound like that could be Yukta Vairagya. Well, a great example is that of Sri Ramanujacharya, who 17 times approached his would-be guru, who sent him away. Don't, you're not fit to be initiated. How about that? Ramanuja. Not fit. You're not fit to be initiated. 17 times he was sent away. Whew, amazing. Then the 18th time he was given the mantra, and his guru told him that this mantra, this the name of this mantra of Narayana, the name of Narayana, is most sacred and pure. It awards liberation. Do not give it to anyone. It's too pure to give to anyone. So, as he was leaving and returning to Sri Rangamaya, that would have been, Ramanuja thought of Goshtipurna, that was his guru's name, Goshtipurna's order, and thought that, well, if by hearing and chanting this mantra you get liberation, then I should give it to everyone. My guru told me not to, but I'll have to go to hell for breaking the order, but everyone else will get liberation. And so he famously called all the people around him and told them all to chant this mantra. Which his guru got the news and became extremely angry and called Ramanuja to come to him, which Ramanuja did, and his guru was very angry and said, so you're going to have to go to hell for breaking my order. And he said, yes, I'm ready to go to hell. But then all the other people will get liberated. And then his guru understood that what a great devotee Ramanuja is. So how far can you go? Are there any limits? No. But no limits for those who know what they're doing. For others who are not great acharyas, we should be more careful. The mind may trick us into thinking that we are bringing in something which is Krishna conscious, but actually we're just making facilities for sense gratification. We have to be very careful also that the facilities which are offered for devotees to live comfortably so that they can prosecute Krishna consciousness don't become an excuse simply for living comfortably. Everyone in this world wants to live comfortably. So if we make nice, we make good facilities where people can live comfortably so they can execute Krishna consciousness, it's not surprising if people occupy those facilities just to live comfortably and forget or minimize the prosecuting Krishna consciousness part, or just prosecute Krishna consciousness as a formality to secure for themselves a position in the comfortable facilities. So these are all dangers of the application of yukta vairagya. When the vairagya becomes slackened, then it's no longer vairagya at all. And then it's no longer Krishna consciousness at all. We shouldn't think that because some revolutionary moves have been made in which certain rules, the following of certain rules have been slackened, that then, well, we can just slacken any rule according to our convenience. Now, something that comes up to me from time to time. When the Krishna consciousness of a person is, they feel that the rules are too restrictive for them. Well, particularly in the case of divorce, someone may think that, well, it's not allowed in Krishna consciousness, but the rules are too restrictive. I just can't go on with this marriage. It's just too much. So if it's restricted, no, you can't, it's not allowed in Krishna consciousness. And then they may say, then I'll go away from Krishna consciousness, but I can't remain in this marriage. So what should you do? Should we advise, okay, you go on chanting Hare Krishna and you get a divorce. I'm citing this because this came up to me recently. And this kind of thing, unfortunately, comes up to me from time to time, although I'm trying to avoid getting involved in such things, because it, in such matters no one ever listens to me anyway, even if they, in all these difficult marriage matters, whenever anyone asks my advice, they only take it if they want to follow it anyway. They never follow it, and hardly they follow it unless it's what they want to do anyway. And then if I say what they want me to say, then that's used to back them up. And if it's not what they want to do, then they just say, well, you know, he don't know what he's talking about anyway. So I largely withdrew from such marriage. I'm trying to withdraw from such marriage matters. So what should we do? Srila Prabhupada, there was a case when one disciple asked Srila Prabhupada for permission to divorce, and Srila Prabhupada granted it, which shocked Srila Prabhupada's servant, Shruti Kirti Prabhu, who I just met a couple of days ago, gave me a little ride on his scooter within the campus in Mayapur. He was shocked, and he asked Srila Prabhupada. He recounted that whenever he wanted to, he was a little timid to ask things from Srila Prabhupada, which is good attitude to have when you're dealing with the acharya of the whole universe. So he would ask questions of Srila Prabhupada. His tendency was to, if at all he asked questions, he would ask them when he was massaging Srila Prabhupada's back. So he asked Srila Prabhupada, he said that divorce is banned in Krishna consciousness, isn't it? Srila Prabhupada said, yes. And then, but you gave permission to this devotee. And then Srila Prabhupada explained that, well, he would have done it anyway, even if I didn't allow it. So I'm allowing it so that anyway he's making one offense, but no, so he doesn't make two offenses of both divorcing and disobeying me. I'm giving him permission. So then Shruti Kirti Prabhu understood this. But then the problem is that everyone takes that as a license to just, well, it's better for my Krishna consciousness, yukta vairagya, I'm becoming detached from my family life by divorcing. Not so laudable. In such a case, what to do? Better remain separated and not divorce, but then people get married because they have certain desires to fulfill, then they want to remarry and remarry and remarry, and goes on and on and on. So, this can't be called yukta vairagya. Yukta vairagya is on a higher platform than bending or breaking the rules just so that one can somehow or other go on in Krishna consciousness. Yukta vairagya is meant for preaching Krishna consciousness. It is meant for serving Krishna in a way that is pleasing to him. Of course, I don't want to condemn anyone here. The world it's a very difficult world that we live in, and we are strongly influenced by the whole sinful ethos around us. People are very disturbed in their minds, but I'm just making the point here that we can't take yukta vairagya as an excuse to treat the rules and regulations of Krishna consciousness and of family life and of vanashram in a flippant way. Rules should be taken seriously. Yashastra vidimutrija vartate kama karataha nasa siddhim avapnoti nasukam naparam datim. Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, describing the persons of demoniac outlook, that they do not follow the rules and regulations, which includes the rules, well, and mostly and would mean the rules and regulations of Varnashram culture. They just don't follow them because they don't want to, that's all. But such people, they do not, though they have other things that they want to do, so they just decide not to follow. They don't think that the rules are very important. But such persons can attain neither perfection, nor happiness, nor the ultimate destination. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he offered opulence, or what we would consider to be, what was considered opulence at the time, to his disciples. Life in the Gaudiya Math at that time, and even at this time, if you go to many of the Gaudiya Maths in India, it is significantly more austere than is normal in ISKCON. This Srila Bhakti Pramod Puri Maharaj recounted that when he had joined the Mart, the Gaudiya Mart in Calcutta, and his sister came to visit him. And when she learned that at night he slept on a bed, and a bed, if you go in the villages around here, you'll see a bed means some crude thing, it's nothing very fancy at all, just practically a platform on four legs. He was using a bed and a mosquito net. She was disgusted. She thought, what's that? Sadhus don't sleep on beds. They don't have mosquito nets. And what do you speak of using any kind of footwear? What to speak of going in cars? Of course, cars were quite uncommon in India at that time, even when I first came to it in 1975, except in the cities. Cars were quite uncommon. It was even motor scooters came a little later. Mostly, those who didn't walk would mostly go on bicycles, like they still do here in the village. Although motorbikes are becoming more common here also. So there was some opulence. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur recognized that there's some risk in that also, in giving good facilities, that not everyone who comes may do so with fully pure motives, or they may become attracted to that opulence. He warned that his disciples, while engaging money, women and prestige in Hari Seva, money and women, Kanaka Kamani, these two well-known terms. Kanaka means gold, and Kamani means woman, especially women perceived as objects of lust. So Kanaka Kamani, these terms are often used, at least in Bengali. I don't know who first used them. They were also used by the so-called Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. So that those terms were in common usage as two objects that sadhus are supposed to have nothing to do with. They should embrace voluntary poverty and have nothing to do with women. In the Gaudiya Math, money was certainly collected. In fact, that was one of the main services of many of the devotees, of many of the disciples, the brahmachari and sannyasi disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to collect money for building mats and for holding festivals. Uh, Women, they didn't have much to do with, although Bhaktisthana, the Brahmacharya Sannyasis didn't have much to do with them, although Bhaktisthana Sarasvati Thakur did initiate some women. Even now, we were just in Puri. I was staying at the birthplace of Srila Bhaktisthana Sarasvati Thakur in Puri, where a mutt was established in the 1970s by Madha Srila Bhakti Dayata Madhav Maharaj. And although the devotees there kindly provided pots for cooking for the festival that we held there, we had how many, about 1,000 devotees there, approximately? 1,300 devotees there. So they kindly provided cooking pots. But they wouldn't allow us to cook in their kitchen because we had many women in our cooking team. That wasn't allowed. Although in some village Gaurya Mats you'll find some old didimar or whatever comes and helps cooking. So Bhaktisthana, and prestige, there's prestige in being a big sadhu, a big sannyasi. So these are to be engaged in Hari Seva. But Bhaktisthana Sarasvati Thakur warned that his disciples should not become entrapped in the deceitfulness of subtle enjoyment, and thus, while ostensibly performing Hari Seva, actually becoming inimical to it. So it is possible that while one is apparently engaged in devotional service, one is actually becoming inimical to it because he doesn't want to give everything to Krishna. He wants to use the facilities that are supposed to be used in devotional service for his own enjoyment. So we have to be very careful of this. We shouldn't presume, when we read this, a person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. Srila Prabhupada finishes this purport with this statement. A person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. So then we shouldn't think, well, I'm in Krishna consciousness, so I'm a perfect yogi. Says right here. There you go, proof. I'm a perfect yogi. Which means, here we go. Yukta Vairagya, I'd rather use a book. A yogi, Krishna states, is free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. Well, I'm. You see, Prabhupada says that the person in Krishna consciousness is the topmost yogi, and that's based on Krishna's statement here that a yogi is free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. So I'm a devotee, so I've got all this opulence, and I'm free from any personal. It's all personal. It's all for Krishna's service. The mind can cheat us. The mind can cheat us. Everything should be offered. Everything for Krishna's pleasure. Krishnarthe akila cheshta. All our endeavors should be simply for Krishna's pleasure. We should not own anything or accumulate anything or desire to have anything unless it is specifically for the service of Krishna. We should not accumulate things unless they can be engaged in the service of Krishna. So there are some thoughts on Yukta Vairagya, and soon the Tulsi Arti will begin here. So in the meantime, if there are any questions, please ask them. Well, there's the answer from another perspective. All go and do namaz. I wonder how many people actually go. Probably not many. Only on Fridays. Yeah. You stated that when we take initiation, our karma stops. Meaning in the sense that our materialistic karma stops. Although the fan turned off effect is still there. But that's not entirely true. even after taking initiation, if we act on the materialistic platform, then we incur materialistic reactions. So what was your question actually? Why are there doubts? Why can one problem go for so many years? Well, you yourself gave the hint to that answer by talking about the fan turned off, still running effect. Why so long? Well, what's long? How many lifetimes have we been in the material world? How long? If we want to see how many lifetimes in it, if you put 10 and then you put to the power of, and you put a 1 and you put the 0 in 10 point typing size, you can probably have it go to the limit of the universe. How many? 10 to the raised to the value of infinity. So how many? You say long time. That's maybe our impatience. Rupa Goswami advises utsaha nischayan dharyat, one quality by which devotional service becomes perfect is, well, the first three qualities he mentions are enthusiasm, determination, and the third one is patience. Another symptom of Sharanagati, or surrender to Krishna, is the confidence that Krishna will protect me, Krishna will save me, despite myself, despite all external problems, and despite even the nonsense in my own mind. If I stick to Krishna, then Krishna will help me. May take many lifetimes. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu banished Mukunda from his association, Mukunda asked through some other of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's associates, when will again I get the chance to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? And the answer came after a million lifetimes. And Mukunda danced in happiness and said, oh, after a million lifetimes again I'll get the chance. He was so happy that again he would get the chance. In the modern age, we expect everything instantly. You touch this and it does something. You hit a light switch, the light comes on. You can get instant coffee. Everything instant. So we think instant bhakti, instant purity, but we have to show to Krishna that we are sincere and serious. It may take time. We've had these wrong attitudes in our heart for many, many lifetimes. So that being unnatural seems natural to us. It is natural to be Krishna conscious, but it seems unnatural to us. Maybe you've had some situation where your hand has been in a cast, or you've been on a bed for some weeks. And then after you've been on a bed for some weeks, you get up and walk and it seems like something very strange. Although actually it's just a normal thing, but you're so unused to it that at first it seems strange. Or when after your hand has been in a cast and you start to use it normally, at first, you're very conscious of it. It seems unusual because what is abnormal has become normal. And that's only for a small thing, for a few weeks. What to speak of millions of lifetimes in Maya. So this process of Krishna consciousness is very powerful. And in a relatively short time, we can become purified. But if we become discouraged because we don't get instant coffee or instant purity, then we lose the opportunity. We cheat ourselves. Yeah. Please. Yeah.
So, this was one thing that was coming up in USA with a couple of book distributors. We were wondering, see, because at least from reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, Antalila chapter 6, with Raghunath Das Goswami, he stopped accepting gold coins from his parents. I'm understanding because they're materialistic. Even if he was going to use it for Chaitanya's service to give Chaitanya festivals every month, but he stopped doing that. So I was wondering, because many times in the U.S., I'll be at the gas station or I'll be at the grocery store and I'll say...
Make it quick. Tulsiati is going to begin soon.
We're monks traveling and would you like to help with just give us some fruits or something? But they're clearly pounds and shillings, man, and I don't actually...
That's a big question. I don't think I have time to discuss that now. Can you put it in writing? Send it to me as an email. I'll get it. It's not a 2-minute discussion. It's a good question, but no time now.
This Kavaragya is more difficult to define in individual cases.
Yeah, difficult to Yuktavaragya, difficult to define in individual cases. Then who will say? Therefore it's best instituted by self-realized acharyas. It's not the prerogative of persons who are not on the level of such an advanced acharya to just willy-nilly change things here and there. Some adaptation to circumstances is always required, but it's always dangerous also. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada, following Rupa Goswami, gave for us a very strong, solid program of sadhana to follow. He gave us his books, in which everything is very clear. He gave us many guidelines on how to preach, how to spread Krishna consciousness. So, although individual circumstances will always require to be judged individually, we do have large stock of Srila Prabhupada's instructions on various circumstances by which we can deduce what should be done and what should not be done. Again, there may be... Actually, in most circumstances, we don't have to think, should this be done or should it not be done? Most circumstances are fairly straightforward. For instance, if we take a book distribution party into Calcutta and distribute books, then It's a fairly straightforward thing. It's done. It's been done thousands of times. Other things, well, how far do we go? Again, the question. I saw recently on the internet that the Rath Yatra organized by devotees in Durban in South Africa, that there were various African tribal dancing groups. So you may say, well, what's that got to do with Krishna consciousness? But then on the other hand, you may say, well, that... I mean, there could be an argument made for that. Well, they're doing their dancing for the pleasure of Lord Jagannath. They may not be directly doing it for the pleasure of Lord Jagannath, but it helps the devotees to blend with the whole spirit of South Africa, in which the motto is... I don't know, different by culture, one as a nation, something like that. So, and you see in Puri, in the Rath Yatra in front of Jagannath, you see all kinds of people come and they do jugglery and all kinds of gymnastics, so you could say. So, should it be done or should it not be done? Well, there might be a danger of just turning it into some kind of mundane carnival. So there could be arguments, pros and cons like that, but in most circumstances, It is fairly straightforward. In other circumstances, then it would be required that senior devotees who are well conversant with Srila Prabhupada's teachings discuss, and it generally in this Kali Yuga especially, things tend to degrade, so it may require that at some point we say we've gone too far and then we have to just bring it back again to the proper standard. And well, this is the kind of thing that religious schisms are born from, that everyone agrees on the teachings, but how to implement them can be the form of a schism. Another basis of schisms is, or schisms, depending on which side of the Atlantic you live on, is different interpretations of the teachings. So, anyway, it seems inevitable. There will be differences of approach and difference of understanding, and then that reifies, to use that fancy word again, into different groups, different sub-sampradayas. Who will decide? It seems practically inevitable that after the appearance of any great teacher, that there will be differences which at the time seem very significant, which cause splits. And then usually after, if the different split up groups go on for some time, after some time they think, well, it's not so. They wonder what their forefathers were fighting about. There was a time when Catholics and Protestants were killing each other. They wouldn't dream of doing that nowadays. For instance, I don't think there's any Catholic or Protestant in the world who would think of killing one from the other group just for being a member of that group, although it was considered the work of God to do so just a short time ago in terms of cosmic time. Hare Krishna, Jagannath Subhadra Baladeva Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.